Hello, I'm Richard Adey. Welcome to EdPod. Today we reflect on Australian of the Year Mick Dodson's ambitious vision for education. He wants every child in Australia to be kitted up and ready for school on the 26th of January next year. He means every Australian child, but acknowledges that the task is far more pressing for Indigenous kids. We'll play you some of the original address at the National Press Club where Professor Dodson threw out his challenge. Then, making the dream a reality, Radio National's Australia Talks recently asked just what it would take to achieve Mick Dodson's goal. How do we get more Indigenous kids to turn up to school and improve their learning? And we'll finish with a very timely insight into the reality of teaching and learning in remote Aboriginal communities. I spoke to teacher Paula Shaw on Life Matters recently about her time teaching in the remote community of Arakoon. She didn't hold back, and it's interesting to get a personal perspective on this big issue. So let's start now with Mick Dodson's dream. Mick Dodson is Director of the Centre for Indigenous Studies at the Australian National University and co-chair of Reconciliation Australia. 2 weeks after he was announced as Australian of the Year for 2009, he spoke at the National Press Club about what he hoped to achieve in the coming year. Mick Dodson.
Now, I've thought a lot in the last couple of weeks about what changes I would like to see by the 26th of January 2010. And where I would most like to make a contribution as Australian of the Year. What I'd like to see is every Australian child next Australia Day geared up and ready for the start of the 2010 school year. And I want to be confident that those kids are going to get the best education this country can give them. I want it for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, and I want it for other children, other Australian children, who aren't getting it now because of where they live, because of poverty, or because we've failed them. Now, don't get me wrong, this isn't a no child will live in poverty statement. This here is the father of two ambitious young women saying that my children and your children, all children, have a right to the best education this country can deliver. And the fact that many of our children are not getting the best education is something none of us should tolerate or dismiss as inevitable or see as too hard to fix. I truly believe we're better than that. And my call this year to each and every Australian will be to play a part in fixing it. That every child deserves a good education, and a country as prosperous as ours should be able to provide it, I think, are things we all agree on. And we've been agreed on it for a very long time. And yet, we still can't do it. And that failure should be an offence to our pride, our benign self-image, and our profession of faith in the fair go. And maybe it is. Maybe that's why we fob off the failure by blaming the kids or the parents or the teachers, or we look for one-size-fits-all solutions, silver bullets that just don't exist. Maybe these habits are symbols of our denial. Well, I want to spend my year as Australian of the Year doing what I can to see that children who are not getting a good education in Australia today get one in the future. And many of these children, of course, are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander kids. And in doing this, I'm going to take a phrase that the Prime Minister has been using lately in talking about the global financial crisis. And for me, that on education, we're all in this together. And if we're all in it together to deal with the crisis that has been decades in the making and upon us for less than 6 months, surely we're all in it together to assure the future of the nation by giving our kids the chance to find and realise their potential. Now, ladies and gentlemen, education is something we've let slide miserably in recent decades. And we've failed a lot of children in that time. And many of those children, a disproportionate number, are Indigenous children. And we've been failing them for a lot longer. We need more investment in teachers and their professional development so that we can reasonably expect them to be good teachers. So more good students will grow up wanting to be teachers. And more teachers will believe in the worth of their vocation and in the potential of every child they teach. We need investment also in curriculum development. For a start, we need curricula that teachers, pupils and parents can understand. School reports they can understand. These things are surely the bare minimum. And we need good minds and common sense to be brought to bear on it. Not education theory or bureaucratic fashion. We need curricula that will fit students for fulfilling useful lives and gives them, all of them, at least a roughly equal chance at happiness. Now, it was never an easy task. But our shame won't be failing. Our shame will be in not trying.
Professor Mick Dodson there, speaking at the National Press Club. You can find more details of Professor Dodson's address, including a link to a full transcript of the speech, at the EdPod website, abc.net.au/rn/EdPod. Now, what would it really take to achieve Mick Dodson's goal? How do we get more Indigenous kids to turn up to school and improve their educational outcomes? Is it about better schools or better communities? Or do the two go hand in hand? These are the questions that Radio National's Australia Talks program put to its listeners and to guests recently. Here's Australia Talks presenter Paul Barclay welcoming Andrew from Sydney.
Oh, g'day. How are you going?
I'm very well.
I've spent the last 5 years running a Indigenous Education Boarding School Scholarship Program in Sydney, and we've got about 40 boys on at St Joseph's College in Hunters Hill, and we're also now expanding into other schools throughout Australia, girls' schools in particular at the moment, and the Prime Minister announced that he was investing $20 million in this last year.
And are those kids coming from remote communities to your school?
Yeah, very much. Basically, the way it works kind of most of the time is that the kids tend to come from remote communities or urban and regional communities, but communities within the state where the schools are.
And how's it going? I mean, how's it going in terms of, I suppose, those children coming to a different environment, fitting in away from their family, away from their community, and also in terms of their educational achievement?
Yeah, well, there's no question that it's hard for any kid to go to boarding school, particularly for 12 or 13 years old. And the key to the success really here is making sure the kids are going to a school where there's a welcoming environment, so that they're not sort of one little black face in a white school. So most of the schools that we work with, we choose specifically because they've got a track record and a reasonable critical mass of Indigenous kids within the schools, and that really helps create a welcoming environment. And they're schools that have got a track record of engaging with families and communities and parents and actually having success in this, and that's a really important part of it. And I just think one of the things you mentioned in your introduction as well was you're talking about, you know, is this sending kids away to boarding school is part of the solution? And I know it's splitting hairs, but it's actually not sending kids anywhere. This is parents and grandmothers and aunties and uncles who are ringing these schools and begging them for an opportunity for their kids to get into these schools. And all that the schools are really doing and all the scholarship programs like us are doing is removing the financial barrier that prevents those parents and families and communities from having those choices. No one's suggesting that anyone be sent away anywhere.
Sure.
And in fact, the really important criteria is that the kids and the families are really enthusiastic and supportive of the opportunity. And that's just a really important thing. You know, certainly boarding school, absolutely no question. This is not the answer for everybody, and this is not the answer for the Indigenous education predicament we have in this country. There's no question about that. It's part of the solution.
It's part of the solution, yeah.
And I think we need to celebrate all of things at work and at the same time keep our attention on how we can improve in other areas.
I think I'll leave it there, Andrew. Great to call to get your call and hear about your experience. And I think Mick Dodson really made it clear that there is no one solution at all. There are just a variety of solutions. And perhaps, as you say, boarding school for some children with the involvement of their parents in the local community may work. But obviously, it's not a one-size-fits-all thing. Let's go to Peter in Benogen. G'day, Peter.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
Yes, I work as a school teacher. And from what I can see, the issue with Indigenous education, I don't think it's essentially any different to any other high needs area. And I think that the main problem we have is that dreaded ratio of whatever 25 or 30 kids at times to the one school teacher. It's the eternal issue that one government after another will always sidestep, will always evade. Oh, we'll knock up some buildings, we'll build a new library. But that dreaded ratio is the thing that always, in my opinion, really limits the success of the teacher. Of course, you've got good teachers, you've got less talented teachers. But
you need more of them.
The ratio is up around 25 to 1, 30 to 1. I don't think you're going to get much in the way of better results there.
Yeah. Thanks, Peter. So let's, before we head back to our guests, hear from Gordon in Innisfail. Hello, Gordon.
G'day. I was a teacher myself. I had 32 years in secondary education in the practical field of manual arts. But I'm basically here to talk about my two sons. Our first son taught at Hopevale up near Cooktown, and that's an Indigenous community. Our other son taught it with his wife now, Julie, taught at Kaunyama and Pomperau.
Mm.
Now, some of the things that they did to create interest, I can say that when our sons were at Pomperau, they had more people attending their classes than the rest of the school, and there were seven teachers in the school. And that only happened because they did interesting things. One of the things that happens, or has happened, is both our sons have been invited back to those community. communities. That only happens if people have hold them in high regard.
Look, I think you've really hit a nail on the head there about some of the ideas in schools that make them work and the creation of a community. And someone who can help us talk a little more about this and a little more about what's working or indeed not working up in the Cape, which is what we've just been hearing about, is Alan Tudge. He's the Deputy Director of the Cape York Institute. G'day, Alan.
G'day, Paul. Thanks for having me on the program.
And seeing as we've brought into the discussion some of the communities in the Cape, can you just give us a snapshot of Indigenous education standards in the Cape and how kids there compare in terms of literacy and numeracy?
Yeah, sure. Basically, Paul, on every available measure, Indigenous students on the Cape are doing poorly. It starts out in terms of the first measure that we have is the Year 2 diagnostic test. And even from there, about 60 to 80% of students require additional support. When you start getting into your year 3, 5 and 7 literacy and numeracy tests, you find that in some schools as few as 20% are actually achieving the minimal standard required for reading. The best from the most recent data was 54%, when in mainstream Australian standards it typically hovers around 90, 92%. The year 12 retention rate is something like between 6 and 12%. Basically, in short, you'd have to describe them as catastrophic
yes.
levels.
Look, they're the outcomes, and clearly they leave a lot to be desired. A fairly fundamental problem, though, is that not enough kids actually get to school. Truancy is a big problem, not just on the Cape, but around the country. Under the leadership of Noel Pearson, I know Cape York's beginning to take something of a hard line on school attendance, and there's a program there linking welfare to school attendance. Any idea about whether that's starting to work?
Yeah, the early indications are that it is starting to work. I mean, it's premised on the view which Noel Pearson articulated in his piece in The Australian the other day, which is basically that children from disadvantaged backgrounds can attend school as well as anyone else. Disadvantage isn't a barrier to attending school. But if you're not at school, clearly it doesn't matter how great the school is, you're not going to learn. And it should be a basic responsibility on parents to send their children to school. So part of the measures which we're trialling in four Cape York communities is linking school attendance to welfare payments, and that if there's a breach occurs, the parents will be brought in front of a panel, which consists of a majority of Indigenous elders who sit on that panel, to make a determination as what should be the consequences of the parent failing to send their children to school.
Mm. Let me bring another voice into the discussion now, Professor Colleen Haywood. And Colleen is the head of the Kurrongkul Katajan Indigenous Studies Centre at Edith Cowan University. Hello, Colleen.
How are you, Paul?
I'm very well. Do you think that we know why truancy is such a problem in Indigenous communities?
I think some of it is about actually about poverty. I take Alan's point that disadvantage is not what stops you from going to school or not, or as a parent it doesn't stop you from sending your children to school. However, it can have an impact in how well equipped children are when they get to school, which will impact in terms of their confidence and readiness. You know, none of us actually like to do something that we're not good at. You know, we tend to veer towards the things that we can do. So if you start year one and you're already behind the eight ball, as 60% of Indigenous kids in the Western Australian context are, and each day that's evident to you, it's not a place that you're necessarily going to want to go. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't. It just means that the systems have to be more responsive. Not only once we get children to school, but what we do with kids and with families and their communities to get them ready before then.
Mm. And Alan Tudge, I suppose compounding that is the fact that if every child turned up for school tomorrow in the Cape York region of Australia, would there be enough schools? Indeed, would there be enough teachers to teach them?
That would be an issue in some communities. In the communities that we're working with and trialling this, that's been discussed at the governmental level, and there's been effort to ensure that that's not the case.
Mm. You're on Australia Talks talking about Indigenous education. How do we get more Indigenous kids to turn up to school and improve their educational outcomes? Is it about better schools or better communities? Or do the two go hand in hand? And do we need to focus on health and housing as much as schools and teachers? We'll talk a little about that on the program next. Let's go to Bathurst and Shona. Hello, Shona.
Oh, hello. How are you going?
Good, thanks.
Good. Okay, there's been so much brought up this evening. Families and schools are not able to actually be differentiated from one another. They absolutely have to have a very strong connection and a resilience for their particular community, for their particular local situation. You may be in a school that has a number of different Indigenous families from different clans, from different... and I'm not an Indigenous person, so I'm struggling with the terminology here.
But you've got a complex array of cultural issues in each community that the schools need to deal with and take into account, I think is what you're saying.
Absolutely, and it's really, really important that those schools get in touch with the elders and the leaders of those families and those communities and engage with them.
And be a part of the community. I think that's a theme that's starting to build through the discussion. Thanks, Shona. To the far south coast of New South Wales, hello, Donna.
Yeah, hi, Paul. I can just hear you. Look, I want to take an opposite approach to the first two callers.
Mm-hmm.
That word engaged has come up a few times. I homeschool my boy who's eight. There's a school 15 k's down the road.
Yes.
I did train to be a teacher. I hated school. I jigged when it was third form, but I became a teacher, and I'm homeschooling my boy, and he's just as bright and capable as everybody else. I think it really would suit the Indigenous community to keep it in the community, like Mick Dodson says, and empower parents or other people, as long as you're a facilitator. I was set to a program. I thought, we'll do this. My lad's just natural learning as they speak. Mm. He's made something great today. He's maths guru. I love books and reading. So it's all that. Kids will learn if it's relevant. And keep them as close to their community. Don't send them away. And, you know, if I want to learn, keep them engaged. And we want to learn. And maybe high school might be a bit different, but offer be a facilitator and give them the resources. But parents and the community can teach their kids. Don't give it over to the school system, you know, if it doesn't work.
Okay, thanks, Donna. I'll leave it there. Let's head to Bridget before we head back to our guest. Hello, Bridget.
Hello. I'd just like to say that I agree with the callers who are suggesting a holistic approach. Currently, our federal health minister is looking at the health situation and bringing a holistic approach there with different practitioners being available to people.
Mm.
I think the education system, particularly in Aboriginal communities, is too important just to leave to teachers alone. I think there's a lot of pressures on teachers in Aboriginal communities. But what if there were other professionals brought in and education became the direction of them, of the whole community, so that it was a holistic approach, just as the last teacher, the last homeschooler said, because I think this works in any situation, but I think it's particularly needed in Aboriginal communities, and I don't agree with the punitive approach. I really don't. Mm. That shows we have failed. That demonstrates our failure. That demonstrates that what white Australia thinks, and I just think it's horrible. But
yes, I suspect actually that Colleen Hayward, you may have some sympathy for the idea that this does need to be an holistic approach, because you previously worked on a very detailed study of Indigenous children at, I think, the Telethon Institute for Child Health, and you were looking there at the relationship between school performance, Indigenous achievement, and physical health, social and emotional well-being, and so forth.
Absolutely. In fact, the callers that we've had have just been fantastic in terms of the issues that they've raised and the perspectives that they've presented. With anything, we've got to be holistic. I am always at a loss when you think about a child as to how you can say, well, this is the bit that's about the education of the child, and this is the bit that's about the health of the child, and this is a bit about how they're accommodated. All of those bits impact on every other bit.
Mm.
I must say within that, that for me, education is fundamental. It's central to every one of those other aspects, and that's really how we have to view it.
Mm, yes. You're listening to a discussion on Australia Talks on Indigenous schooling and how we improve. Let's go to Michael in Townsville. Hi, Michael.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I work in community support, and we do emergency food here at our local Baptist church. And what we find is that families won't send their kids to school if they don't have food because they're afraid of being turned into the Department of Child Safety.
Mm.
So that's the number one reason we were talking about truancy that we see. So we partner with Child Safety. We partner with the schools to make sure that the kids have enough food. So it's part of it is just practical, thinking on a practical level about basic things that keep their kids from coming to school.
Yep. Get a good feed in their tummies. James is on Palm Island, which is an interesting place to get a perspective from. Hi, James.
How are you going?
Good. You're a teacher on Palm Island?
Yes, I'm on Palm now. I've been for 10 years all around very remote schools, from Kintore out west of Alice up to the Kimberleys, up to Manangreta. Just a couple of quick points. One of the things that was done at Manangreta some years ago was research on what should be done, and the person that did the research suggested that the place to start was with the parents. Like when we grow up as mainstream young kids, we have books, we have people talk about different careers. We sort of have an understanding about school and about learning. And everywhere I've been, there's nothing like that. There's no understanding in the community. The community says we want our kids to learn. And I think that it would be really, really good to do that. Now, just a couple of quick points. We've got classes here from between, say, 20 to 25. And these kids, even though they speak Aboriginal English, they still are really second language learners. Now, in LOAT, languages other than English, there's 12 kids maximum to one teacher. Here, you're struggling with up to 20 kids. Now, we've got a wonderful school, wonderful staff, wonderful admin, but the same problem, you've got about 60% of the kids looking up, keen to learn. One little girl the other day broke my heart. She said she wants to become a lawyer, but she's been kept back by kids who are deaf, kids who can't read and write, kids who actually need specialist help. And I think we should give up this sort of inclusive classroom and work hard with the groups that are lost it. You know, we've got kids from say, grade five who cannot read and write. They can't do what a kindergarten kid can do in the mainstream.
Yeah. Just on the literacy and numeracy issue, Alan Tudge, Cape York has sought out a particular remedial literacy and numeracy program, Multilit. It was developed at Macquarie University. How's that scheme performing and how does it compare with the standard approach in Queensland schools?
Yeah, we've advocated the use of this remedial literacy program, or an accelerated literacy program, we should really call it, called Multilit, which stands for Making Up for Lost Time in Literacy, and as you say, it was developed by Macquarie University. It's been used mainly in western and disadvantaged parts of Sydney, as well as in Brisbane. We've trialled it for the first time now up in the Cape, with results which have been equally as impressive as they have been in non-Indigenous settings, where, for example, some of the typically students will gain on average 15 to 20 months in reading accuracy and comprehension in less than 6 months of instruction. So we believe that, and this isn't the only program, we happen to believe it's the best, but there are other also very good remedial literacy programs. But it is absolutely fundamental that they are rolled out into other particularly remote community schools where the disadvantage is so stark.
Paul Barclay on Australia Talks with a very interesting discussion on what it will take to improve school attendance and outcomes for Indigenous children. And to finish EdPod today, a very personal account of what it takes to teach and learn in remote Aboriginal communities. When she was 26, teacher Paula Shaw moved to Arakoon in far north Queensland. She found lots of run-down houses, dogs full of ticks, and an adult population that didn't necessarily see school as the most important place for their children to be. Paul has written an account of her nearly 2 years there, where she learnt firsthand what some of the obstacles are for successful schooling for Aboriginal kids. I welcomed Paula into the Life Matters studio recently and asked her what made her want to go to Arakoon when she knew it wasn't going to be the easiest place in the world to teach.
Yeah, I think I knew it wasn't going to be the easiest place in the world. Exactly what it was going to be like, I actually didn't have much of an idea. I'd studied anthropology and I'd studied to be a teacher of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander studies, but the difference between book learning and actually in real life having to be in this other culture that is a very, very different culture is a real challenge, and it's difficult.
Yes. Well, can you describe your first day in the classroom?
First day in the classroom was lovely. They were all quiet. They all listened. It was after the first day when it really got interesting and that I started to really understand exactly what kind of a complicated and difficult task was ahead of me. And, you know, things like, you know, I've got 15 kids in my class out of the 26 who are on my roll.
Yeah.
I've got this 15 on Monday, but on Tuesday I've got a completely different 15 kids. Oh, well, there's some overlap. But
yeah.
Trying to have a program, a work program for your students that works for kids who have come every day as well as for the kids who you actually haven't seen for the last 3 weeks is an extremely difficult thing to do. You've got kids with very widely differing levels of literacy. You've got kids from different clan groups. There are 5 different clan groups in Arakoon, so you can have...
Some of which do not get on
that. Some of which most certainly do not get along with each other, and it can be really inappropriate to ask, one kid who you think, oh, this kid's got great literacy skills, I'm going to team them up with this kid whose literacy isn't so great and they can work together. Don't just make that assumption that that can work, because there might be a whole host of reasons why that's inappropriate. It might be that those 2 kids are from families that do not get along, or it might be that, in fact, they're from the same family, but you've just asked a niece to tell her auntie what to do.
And you're kind of feeling your way toward this without the language.
Yeah. It is all in another language. Of course, the kids do speak an Aboriginal English and they are learning standard Australian English, and some of them actually speak standard Australian English really well.
Mm.
But there are certainly kids in your classroom who don't understand what you are saying. And in their interactions with each other, it's almost all in Wikmunkan. So trying to key into what is going on with that is pretty hard work.
So who's interpreting?
Often no one.
That's right.
Sometimes your community teacher will. Often it's no one, which means that you need to...
When your community teacher's there.
Yeah, when your community teacher's there, sometimes they'll do it, and sometimes that's not a role they take either. Kids translate for each other often, for kids who really have problems understanding standard Australian English. But you get much, much better at simplifying your language, at breaking it down to what you really mean to say.
Can I get you to, because I think one of the things that is interesting in the book is that you have the roll call. Can I get you to do the roll call for us?
Sure. Kalki yora yankapora nakyankwaka korkatane akwukurum awokurum pambigan tamoy bell. Ampabegan Nampanam Kayuka Mudanati, Punkamelia Mapundan, Kumida Shotjo Tisman, Puchamanka Pimagina, Nalamata Kerendan, Kuwepta Kungodama, Kunada Wallumbeng, Tolkaikan, Taibin Gumpa, Kundumban Quinkan Keppel, Kawanka Kawada Koala, Wikmunya Wombi Wulla.
That brings it home, I think, as well as anything, that you are in another country, in effect. You are
absolutely. It's Australia, but it's another country. It's another culture. It's a completely other culture. It's more different than a lot of other cultures that I've spent time in, you know.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Paula Shaw, who's written a really beautifully written, very easy to read, 7 Seasons in Arakoon, which is about her time in a remote Aboriginal school. Can I get you to tell me about living there? Because you were right in the middle of town.
Yep. The first house I lived in was opposite what is rather insensitively called Bicentennial Park. And Bicentennial Park is where lots of the big fights happen.
It came out of the pub.
People would come out of the tavern, walk down to Bicentennial Park and do their formations, and that's where a lot of the fights would happen. It's also where the church takeaway is, and for a while it's where the church services were held on Sunday mornings. So, you know, from my front veranda, I could have a pretty good view of what was going on in town and get a sense of what the day was going to be like by what the foot traffic was doing, whether people were moving kind of in swarms towards a fight or if it was a nice, calm day. Lots of kids on bikes and...
Fights seem to figure fairly prominently.
They do. They're a big part of community life and a big part of how local politics works. I've recently read in a book that Ruth Park wrote about violence as a theatre of the disenfranchised, and it just was like, oh, makes instant sense to me that, yeah, that is what was going on. This is where they have power in their lives, so why wouldn't it be huge? Yeah.
But you're now in this community and you're in the middle of it, so there's noise, there's heat, there's lots of bad 80s music out of bad speakers.
Yeah. Why the speakers are always broken, I don't know. But, you know, it's quite painful to try and go to sleep listening to...
And lots of... And a fair bit of stolen cars doing burnouts.
Yeah. There was quite a significant petrol sniffing problem there when I was there, which seemed to almost grow out of the beginnings of the alcohol management plan.
This was 2003 and 4, basically.
Yeah, 2003 and 4. Apparently that has calmed down somewhat, but for a while there it was quite, you know, every day that there'd be another stolen car. The record when I was there was 14 utes stolen in one night.
Where are they stolen from?
The council sheds, the council lockup
right.
area. Yeah, they're all council vehicles.
Right. Mm. And one of the things I was really surprised was that when somebody's hooning around in a stolen car, you don't go outside.
No, it's quite dangerous to go out on the street when there's a, you know, a car burning around the streets. And I mean, you can, but you do it at your own risk. And,
yeah.
You know, the kids who are driving the cars have excellent, amazing reactions. The tricks you see them do are quite impressive, but you still wouldn't want to risk, being in the way if the car did a big skid or... Yeah, there were definitely quite a few times where I was late to school and kids were late to school because there was a stolen car going around and they didn't want to walk down the street.
No. Mm. Amid all this, you're trying to keep kids interested in school,
yeah.
engaged, and one of the things you did was you tried the outdoor approach.
Yeah, getting kids out on country is a fantastic thing to do if you can do it. You know, they have more control.
They know
control.
More than you,
then. They know so much more than I do, definitely, out there. But once again, it's a difficult thing to organise logistically. You need vehicles, you need boats.
You need permission.
You need permission. You need people to drive the boats. You need better, you know, adult to student ratios to get out on country. You can't do it with one teacher and 26 kids. Well, not. Yeah, I didn't have 26 kids actually turn up in my class that often. But yeah.
There's one story you tell where you go to this place and they want to go for a swim and they go for a swim and you notice none of the adults who are there are going to get in the water.
Yeah.
You get in the water because you figure that if something happens, you're a better place to help. But then you notice that they still no adults get in the water.
It was quite scary because, you know, it's a reality. There are crocodiles there, and I've seen some enormous crocodiles sliding into the river where I was in a tiny little tinny going along. So you know they're there, but the kids just jumped into the water and they're splashing around, and it looked to me like they didn't actually know how to swim. So I was much more concerned actually about one of them getting washed downstream.
Yeah.
You know, how you fulfill duty of care in that kind of a situation, I don't really know.
Problematic.
Yeah.
And you do tell a great story about your time there, but often what you see isn't easy to live with. It's not easy to witness. There's injured people. There's people hurting each other. There's sick people. There's sick kids. There's sick dogs. It's hard.
It's really hard. That's, you know, and that is basically the struggle for me in the story and in my life in being there was I wanted to be there and there were things that I really loved about being there. But it was really, really, really hard and exhausting and physically and emotionally draining. By the end, I just couldn't. I physically couldn't do it anymore.
And this is the community that's become notorious since then, last year with the trial of a group of young men and boys who raped a 10-year-old girl.
Mm. Yeah, there are very, very hard things that happen in that community. There are a lot of people whose lives are in total crisis. It's a hard place.
But you also... had some fantastic kids.
They are fantastic kids. You know, I, at the same time as feeling like I couldn't do it anymore, I still do feel hopeful about those kids and that community and what's possible, because they are spunky, fantastic kids who are really smart.
But, I mean, will they get the education they deserve?
Hopefully. Some of them will. There are some young women who... Last year I had the opportunity to go back and I actually did talk with some of the young girls who I'd taught when they were grade 4 and 5 and who are now 15 and 16. And there are a couple of those who have been out at boarding school and are doing really well, and there are also a couple of those who are really smart, deserving kids, and I know that they're not going to get there. And part of it is opportunity, and part of it is that they are entrenched in life there, you know, that this is their home, this is their culture, they have family obligations, they can't just leave. And it's also a really difficult thing to ask a kid to do, to go and live in a place where they are in a completely other culture. You know?
Noel Pearson, of course, has called for compulsory attendance, and there's a trial already underway in Cape York, including Aracoon.
Mm-hmm.
Mick Dodson has called the government to account, saying if every kid isn't attending the school by next Australia Day, we are letting Aboriginal kids down.
Yeah, you know, yes, that's kind of true, but it's also a very difficult thing to realise. If every kid suddenly turned up at the school, certainly when I was there, we just didn't have the physical resources to deal with it.
So it was not built to be big enough, or the population.
The population has grown.
Right.
The population has certainly grown, but, you know, you're talking about young people who have no school behaviours, so they don't know what's expected of them when they come into school. They're not going to, you know, it's not like you can set it up as a classroom, as if in China where they have 60 kids in a class, but they all sit there and listen.
Yeah.
It's young people who are used to being completely autonomous, making their own decisions, deciding exactly where and when they're going to do anything.
You now live in a capital city and you work for a government department. What do you miss most about that time?
Oh, there's so much that I miss. I've never felt... I'm going to cry. I never felt as fully alive as I did when I was living there. You know, you are completely engaged and you have to be. That's part of why it's so exhausting. But it's wonderful, you know. Everybody knows you. You have a role. People notice if you're not there.
Mm.
In the city, you just disappear. You don't mean anything. Where you really do there. You have to be involved in life.
Paula Shaw's book, Seven Seasons in Aracoon, is just out. It's from Allen and Unwin. And I have to say, it's a very enjoyable, very easy-to-read book. That's it for EdPod. Hope you can join me again next time. I'm Richard Ady.